Styros raged, saying things he would not dare repeat before the full council. He presumed too much on his long association with Tuek.
I tell you, she is sitting here surrounded by adults intent upon justifying themselves to her and to God.
Tuek could not let such words pass. Leaning close to the high priest, Styros grated,
She is at the center of an educational system geared to anything her imagination demands. We deny her nothing.
Nor should we. It was as though Tuek had not spoken. Styros said,
Kenya has provided her with recordings from Dar es Balat.
I am the Book of Fate, Tuek intoned, quoting God's own words from the Horde at Dar es Balat.
Exactly, and she listens to every word.
Why does this disturb you? Tuek asked in his calmest tone.
We don't test her knowledge. She tests ours.
God must want it so. No mistaking the bitter anger on Styros' face. Tuek observed this and waited while the old counselor marshaled new arguments. Resources for such arguments were, of course, enormous. Tuek did not deny this. It was the interpretations that mattered, which was why a high priest must be the final interceptor. Despite, or perhaps because of, their way of viewing history, the priesthood knew a great deal of how God had come to reside on Rakkas. They had Dar es Balat itself, and all of its contents, the earliest known note chamber in the universe. For millennia, while Shai-Hulud translated the verdant planet of Arrakis into desert Rakkas, Dar es Balat waited under the sands. From that holy hoard, the priesthood possessed God's own voice, his printed words, and even holophotos. Everything was explained, and they knew that the desert surface of Rakkas reproduced the original form of the planet, the way it looked in the beginning, when it was the only known source of the holy spice.
She asks about God's family, Styros said. Why should she have to ask about...
She tests us. Do we give them their proper places? The Reverend Mother Jessica to her son, Moadib, to his son, Leto II, the Holy Triumvirate of Heaven.
Leto III, Styros muttered. What of the other Leto who died at Sardaukar hands? What of him?
Careful, Styros, Tuek intoned. You know my great-grandfather pronounced upon that question from this very bench. Our divided God was reincarnated with part of him remaining in heaven to mediate the ascendancy. That part of him became nameless then, as the true essence of God should always be.
Oh?
Tuek heard the terrible cynicism in the old man's voice. Styros' words seemed to tremble in the incense-laden air, inviting terrible retribution.
Then why does she ask how our Leto was transformed into the divided god? Styros demanded.
Did Styros question the holy metamorphosis? Tuek was aghast. He said,
In time she will enlighten us. Our feeble explanations must fill her with dismay, Styros sneered.
You go too far, Styros. Indeed? You do not think it enlightening that she asks how the sand trout encapsulates most of Rakkas water and recreate the desert?
Tuek tried to conceal his growing anger. Styros did represent a powerful faction in the priesthood, but his tone and his words raised questions that had been answered by high priests long ago. The metamorphosis of Leto II had given birth to uncounted sand trout, each carrying a bit of himself. Sand trout to divided God. The sequence was known and worshipped. To question this denied God.
You sit here and do nothing, Styros accused. We are pawns of...
Enough.
Tuek had heard all he wanted to hear of this old man's cynicism. Drawing his dignity around him, Tuwek spoke the words of God. Your Lord knows very well what is in your heart. Your soul suffices this day as a reckoner against you. I need no witnesses. You do not listen to your soul, but listen instead to your anger and your rage. Styros retired in frustration. After considerable thought, Tuwek enrobed himself in his most suitable finery of white, gold, and purple. He went to visit Shiana. Shiana was in the roof garden atop the central priestly complex, there with Kenya and two others. A young priest named Baldic, who was in Tuwek's private service, and an acolyte priestess named Kapuna, who behaved too much like a reverend mother for Tuwek's liking. The sisterhood had its spies here, of course, but Tuwek did not like to be aware of it. Kapuna had taken over much of Shiana's physical training, and there had grown a rapport between child and acolyte priestess that aroused Kenya's jealousy. Even Kenya, however, could not stand in the way of Shiana's commands. The four of them stood beside a stone bench almost in the shadow of a ventilator tower. Kapuna held Shiana's right hand, manipulating the child's fingers. Shiana was growing tall, Tuwek noted. 6 years she had been his charge. He could see the first beginnings of breasts poking out her robe. There was not a breath of wind on the rooftop, and the air felt heavy in Tuwek's lungs. Tuwek glanced around the garden to assure himself that his security arrangements were not being ignored. One never knew from what quarter danger might appear. Four of Tuwek's own personal guards, well armed but concealing it, shared the rooftop at a distance, one at each corner. The parapet enclosing the garden was a high one, just the guards' heads standing above the rim. The only building higher than this priestly tower was Keen's primary wind trap, about 1,000 meters to the west. Despite the visible evidence that his security orders were being carried out, Tuwek sensed danger. Was God warning him? Tuwek still felt disturbed by Styros' cynicism. Was it wrong to allow Styros that much latitude? Shiana saw Tuwek approaching and stopped the odd finger-flexing exercises she was performing at Kapuna's instructions. Giving every appearance of knowledgeable patience, the child stood silently with her gaze fixed on the high priest, forcing her companions to turn and watch with her. Shiana did not find Tuwek a fearsome figure. She rather liked the old man, although some of his questions were so bumbling, and his answers. Quite by accident, she had discovered the question that most disturbed Tuwek. Why? Some of the attendant priests interpreted her question aloud as, "Why do you believe this?" Shiana immediately picked up on this, and thereafter her probings of Tuwek and the others took the unvarying form, "Why do you believe this?" Tuwek stopped about 2 paces from Shiana and bowed. "Good afternoon, Shiana." He twisted his neck nervously against the collar of his robe. The sun felt hot on his shoulders, and he wondered why the child chose to be out here so often. Shiana maintained her probing stare at Tuwek. She knew this gaze disturbed him. Tuwek cleared his throat. When Shiana looked at him that way, he always wondered, "Is it God looking at me through her eyes?" Kenya spoke. "Shiana has been asking today about the fish speakers." In his most unctuous tones, Tuwek said, "God's own holy army." "All of them women?" Shiana asked. She spoke as though she could not believe it. To those at the base of Rakian society, fish speakers were a name from ancient history, people cast out in the famine times. "She is testing me," Tuwek thought. Fish speakers. The modern carriers of the name had only a small trading spying delegation on Rakis, composed of both men and women. Their ancient origins no longer were significant to their current activities.
mostly working as an arm of Ix. "Men always serve the fish speakers in an advisory capacity," Tuwek said. He watched carefully to see how Shiana would respond.
"Then there were always the Duncan Idahos," Kenya said.
"Yes, yes, of course, the Duncans." Tuwek tried not to scowl. That woman was always interpreting. Tuwek did not like being reminded of this aspect to Gon's historical presence on Rakkas. The recurrent Gola and his position in the Holy Army carried overtones of Benit Lilac's indulgence. But there was no avoiding the fact that fish speakers had guarded the Duncans from harm, acting, of course, at the behest of God. The Duncans were holy, no doubt of it, but in a special category. By God's own account, he had killed some of the Duncans himself, obviously translating them immediately into heaven.
"Kapuna has been telling me about the Bene Gesserit," Shiana said.
How the child's mind darted around. Tuwek cleared his throat, recognizing his own ambivalent attitude toward the Reverend Mothers. Reverence was demanded for those who were beloved of God, such as the saintly Chenoweth. And the first high priest had constructed a logical account of how the holy Hui Nori, bride of God, had been a secret Reverend Mother. Honoring these special circumstances, the priesthood felt an irritating responsibility toward the Bene Gesserit, which was carried out chiefly by selling melange to the sisterhood at a price ridiculously below that charged by the Tlilazu. In her most ingenuous tones, Shiana said,
"Tell me about the Bene Gesserit, Hedley."
Tuwek glanced sharply at the adults around Shiana, trying to catch a smile on their faces. He did not know how to deal with Shiana calling him by his first name that way. In one sense, it was demeaning. In another sense, she honored him by such intimacy.
"God tests me sorely," he thought.
"Are the Reverend Mothers good people?" Shiana asked. Tuwek sighed. The records all confirmed that God harbored reservations about the sisterhood. God's words have been examined carefully and submitted finally to a high priest's interpretation. God did not let the sisterhood threaten his golden path. That much was clear.
"Many of them are good," Tuwek said.
"Where is the nearest Reverend Mother?" Shiana asked.
"At the sisterhood's embassy here in Keene," Tuwek said.
"Do you know her?"
"There are many Reverend Mothers in the Bene Gesserit keep," he said.
"What's a keep?"
"That's what they call their home here."
"One Reverend Mother must be in charge. Do you know that one?"
"I knew her predecessor, Tamerlane. But this one is new. She has only just arrived. Her name is Odred."
"That's a funny name."
Tuwek's own thoughts, but he said, "One of our historians tells me it is a form of the name Atreides."
Shiana reflected upon this.
Atreides.
That was the family that had brought Shaitan into being. Before the Atreides, there had been only the Fremen and Shai-Hulud. The oral history, which her people preserved against all priestly prohibition, chanted the begats of the most important people on Rakkas. Shiana had heard these names many nights in her village. Modib begat the tyrant. The tyrant begat Shaitan. Shiana did not feel like arguing truth with Tuwek. Anyway, he looked tired today. She said merely,
"Bring me this Reverend Mother Odred."
Kapuna hid a gloating smile behind her hand. Tuwek stepped back, aghast. How could he comply with such a demand? Even the Rakian priesthood did not command the Bene Gesserit. What if the sisterhood refused him? Could he offer a gift of melange in exchange? That might be a sign of weakness. The Reverend Mothers might bargain. No harder bargainers live than the sisterhood's cold-eyed Reverend Mothers. This new one, this Odred, looked to be one of the worst. All of these thoughts fled through Tuwek's mind in an instant. Kenya intruded, giving Tuwek the needed approach.
Perhaps Kapuna could convey Shiana's invitation, Kenya said.
Tuwek darted a glance at the young acolyte priestess.
Yes.
Many suspected, Kenya among them obviously, that Kapuna spied for the Bene Gesserit. Of course, everyone on Rakis spied for someone.
Tuwek put on his most gracious smile as he nodded to Kapuna.
Do you know any of the Reverend Mothers, Kapuna?
Some of them are known to me, my Lord High Priest, Kapuna said.
At least she still shows the proper deference.
Excellent, Tuwek said. Would you be so kind as to start this gracious invitation from Shiana moving up through the Sisterhood's embassy?
I will do my poor best, my Lord High Priest.
I'm sure you will.
Kapuna began a prideful turn toward Shiana, the knowledge of success growing within her. Shiana's request had been ridiculously easy to ignite, given the techniques provided by the Sisterhood. Kapuna smiled and opened her mouth to speak. A movement at the parapet about 40 meters behind Shiana caught Kapuna's attention. Something glinted in the sunlight there. Something small and...
With a strangled cry, Kapuna grabbed up Shiana, hurled her at the startled Tuwek, and shouted, "Run!"
With that, Kapuna dashed toward the swiftly advancing brightness, a tiny seeker trailing a long length of shiga wire. In his younger days, Tuwek had played batball. He caught Shiana instinctively, hesitated for an instant, and then recognized the danger. Whirling with the squirming, protesting girl in his arms, Tuwek dashed through the open door of the stair tower. He heard the door slam behind him, and Kania's rapid footsteps close on his heels.
What is it? What is it?
Shiana pounded her fists against Tuwek's chest as she shouted.
Hush, Shiana, hush!
Tuwek paused on the first landing. Both a chute and suspensor drop led from this building into the building's core. Kenya stopped beside Tuwek, her panting loud in the narrow space.
It killed Kapuna and two of your guards, Kenya gasped. Cut them up. I saw it. God preserve us.
Tuwek's mind was a maelstrom. Both the chute and the suspensor drop system were enclosed wormholes through the tower. They could be sabotaged. The attack on the roof might be only one element in a far more complex plot.
Put me down, Shiana insisted. What's happening?
Tuwek eased her to the floor, but kept one of her hands clutched in his hand. He bent over her.
Shiana, dear, someone is trying to harm us.
Shiana's mouth formed a silent, oh, then...
They hurt Kapuna?
Tuwek looked up at the roof door. Was that an ornithopter he heard up there?
Styros.
Conspirators could take three vulnerable people into the desert so easily. Kenya had regained her breath.
I hear a thopter, she said.
Shouldn't we be getting away from here?
We will go down by the stairs, Tuwek said. But the...
Do as I say. Keeping a firm hold on Shiana's hand, Tuwek led the way down to the next landing. In addition to the chute and suspensor access, this landing had a door into a wide, curving hall. Only a few short steps beyond the door lay the entrance to Shiana's quarters, once Tuwek's own quarters. Again he hesitated.
Something's happening on the roof, Kenya whispered.
Tuwek looked down at the fearfully silent child beside him. Her hand felt sweaty.
Yes, there was some sort of uproar on the roof. Shouts, the hiss of burners, much running about.
The roof door, now out of sight above them, crashed open. This decided Tuwek. He flung open the door into the hallway and dashed out into the arms of a tightly grouped wedge of black-robed women. With an empty sense of defeat, Tuwek recognized the woman at the point of the wedge, Odraid. Someone plucked Shiana away from him and hustled her back into the press of robed figures. Before Tuwek or Kenya could protest, hands were clapped over their mouths. Other hands pinioned them against a wall of the hallway. Some of the robed figures went through the doorway and up the stairs. "The child is safe, and that's all that's important for the moment," Odraid whispered. She looked into Tuwek's eyes. "Make no outcry." The hand was removed from his mouth. Using voice, she said, "Tell me about the roof." Tuwek found himself complying without reservation. A seeker towing a long shigawire came over the parapet. Kapuna saw it and... "Where is Kapuna?" "Dead," Kenya saw it. Tuwek described Kapuna's brave dash toward the threat. "Kapuna dead," Odraid thought. She concealed a fiercely angry sense of loss. What a waste. There must be admiration for such a brave death. But the loss. The sisterhood always needed such courage and devotion. But it also required the genetic wealth Kapuna had represented. It was gone, taken by these stumbling fools. At a gesture from Odraid, the hand was removed from Kenya's mouth. "Tell me what you saw," Odraid said. "The seeker whipped the shigawire around Kapuna's neck, and..." Kenya shuddered. The dull thump of an explosion reverberated above them. Then silence. Odraid waved a hand. Robed women spread along the hallway, moving silently out of sight beyond the curve. Only Odraid and two others, both chill-eyed younger women with intense expressions, remained beside Tuwek and Kenya. Shiana was nowhere to be seen. "The Ixians are in this somewhere," Odraid said. Tuwek agreed. That much shigawire. "Where have you taken the child?" he asked. "We are protecting her," Odraid said. "Be still." She tipped her head, listening. A robed woman sped back around the curve of the hallway and whispered something in Odraid's ear. Odraid produced a tight smile. "It is over," Odraid said. "We will go to Shiana." Shiana occupied a softly cushioned blue chair in the main room of her quarters. Black-robed women stood in a protective arc behind her. The child appeared to Tuwek quite recovered from the shock of the attack and escape. But her eyes glittered with excitement and unasked questions. Shiana's attention was directed at something off to Tuwek's right. He stopped and looked there, gasping at what he saw. A naked male body lay against the wall in an oddly crumpled position. The head twisted until the chin lay back over the left shoulder. Open eyes stared out with the emptiness of death. Styros. The shredded rags of Styros' robe, obviously torn from him violently, lay in an untidy heap near the body's feet. Tuwek looked at Odraid. "He was in on it," she said. "There were face dancers with the Ixians." Tuwek tried to swallow in a dry throat. Kenya shuffled past him toward the body. Tuwek could not see her face, but Kenya's presence reminded him that there had been something between Styros and Kenya in their younger days. Tuwek moved instinctively to place himself between Kenya and the seated child. Kenya stopped at the body and nudged it with a foot. She turned a gloating expression on Tuwek. "I had to make sure he was really dead," she said. Odraid glanced at a companion. "Get rid of the body." She looked at Shiana. It was Odraid's first chance for a more careful study of the child since leading the assault force here to deal with the attack on the temple complex. Tuwek spoke behind Odraid. "Reverend Mother, could you explain, please, what..." Odraid interrupted without turning. "Later." Shiana's expression quickened at Tuwek's words. "I thought you were a Reverend Mother." Odraid merely nodded. What a fascinating child. Odred experienced the sensation she felt while standing in front of the ancient painting in Taraz's quarters. Some of the fire that had gone into the work of art inspired Odred now. Wild inspiration. That was the message from the mad Van Gogh. Chaos brought into magnificent order. Was that not part of the sisterhood's coda? This child is my canvas, Odred thought. She felt her hand tingle to the feeling of that ancient brush. Her nostrils flared to the smells of oils and pigments. Leave me alone with Shiana, Odred ordered. Everybody out! Tuek started to protest, but stopped when one of Odraid's robed companions gripped his arm. Odred glared at him. The Bene Gesserit have served you before, she said. This time we saved your life. The woman holding Tuek's arm tugged at him. Answer his questions, Odred said, but do it somewhere else. Kenia took a step toward Shiana. That child is my... Leave! Odred barked, all the powers of voice in the command. Kenia froze. You almost lost her to a bumbling lot of conspirators, Odred said, glaring at Kenia. We will consider whether you get any further opportunity to associate with Shiana. Tears started in Kenya's eyes, but Odred's condemnation could not be denied. Turning, Kenia fled with the others. Odred returned her attention to the watchful child. We've been a long time waiting for you, Odred said. We will not give those fools another opportunity to lose you. Law always chooses sides on the basis of enforcement power. Morality and legal niceties have little to do with it when the real question is, who has the clout? Bene Gesserit Council Proceedings, Archives Number XOX232. Immediately after Taraza and her party left Camus, Teg threw himself into his work. New in-key procedures had to be laid out, holding Shuang Yu at arm's length from the Gola. Taraza's orders. She can observe all she wants. She can't touch. In spite of the work pressures, Teg found himself staring into space at odd moments, prey to free-floating anxiety. The experience of rescuing Taraza's party from the guild ship and Odraid's odd revelations did not fit into any data classification he constructed. Dependencies. Key logs. Teg found himself seated in his own workroom. An assignment schedule projected in front of him with shift changes to approve, and for a moment he had no idea of the time or even the date. It took a moment to relocate himself. Mid-morning. Taraza and her party had been gone 2 days. He was alone. Yes, Patrine had taken over this day's training schedule with Duncan, freeing Teg for the command decisions. The workroom around Teg felt alien, yet when he looked at each element in it, he found each thing familiar. Here was his own personal data console. His uniform jacket had been draped neatly across a chair back beside him. He tried to fall into Mentat mode, and found his own mind resisting. He had not encountered that phenomenon since training days. Training days. Taraza and Odred, between them, had thrown him back into some form of training. Self-training. In a detached way, he felt his memory offering up a long-ago conversation with Taraza. How familiar it was. He was right there, caught in the moments of his own memory snare. Both he and Taraza had been quite tired after making the decisions and taking the actions to prevent a bloody confrontation. The Barandico incident. Nothing but a hiccup in history now,
but at the time it had demanded all of their combined energies. Terrazza invited him into the small parlor of her quarters on her no-ship after the agreement was signed. She spoke casually, admiring his sagacity, the way he had seen through to the weaknesses that would force a compromise. They had been awake and active for almost 30 hours, and Teig was glad for the opportunity to sit while Terrazza dialed her food drink installation. It dutifully produced 2 tall glasses of creamy brown liquid. Teig recognized the smell as she handed him his glass. It was a quick source of energy, a pick-me-up that the Bene Gesserit seldom shared with outsiders. But Terrazza no longer considered him an outsider. His head tipped back, Teig took a long swallow of the drink, his gaze on the ornate ceiling of Terrazza's small parlor. This no-ship was an old-fashioned model, built in the days when more care had been taken with decoration. Heavily incised cornices, Baroque figures carved in every surface. The taste of the drink pushed his memory back into childhood, the heavy infusion of melange. "My mother made this for me whenever I was overly strenuous," he said, looking at the glass in his hand. He already could feel the calming energy flow through his body. Terrazza took her own drink to a chair dog opposite him, a fluffy white bit of animate furniture that fitted itself to her with the ease of long familiarity. For Teig, she had provided a traditional green upholstered chair, but she saw his glance flick across the chair dog and grinned at him. "Tastes differ, Miles." She sipped her drink and sighed. "My, that was strenuous, but it was good work. There were moments when it was right on the edge of getting very nasty." Teig found himself touched by her relaxation. No pose, no ready-made mask to set them apart and define their separate roles in the Bene Gesserit hierarchy. She was being obviously friendly, and not even a hint of seductiveness. So this was just what it seemed to be, as much as that could be said about any encounter with a reverend mother. With quick elation, Teig realized that he'd become quite adept at reading Alma Mavis Terrazza, even when she adopted one of her masks. "Your mother taught you more than she was told to teach you," Terrazza said. "A wise woman, but another heretic. That's all we seem to be breeding nowadays." "Heretic?" He was caught by resentment. "That's a private joke in the sisterhood," Terrazza said. "We're supposed to follow a Mother Superior's orders with absolute devotion. And we do. Except when we disagree." Teig smiled and took a deep draught of his drink. "It's odd," Terrazza said. "But while we were in that tight little confrontation, I found myself reacting to you as I would to one of my sisters." Teig felt the drink warming his stomach. It left a tingling in his nostrils. He placed the empty glass on a side table and spoke while looking at it. "My eldest daughter. That would be Demela. You should have let us have her, Miles. It was not my decision." "But one word from you..." Terrazza shrugged. "Well, that's past. What about Demela?" "She thinks I'm often too much like one of you."
"Too much?"
"She is fiercely loyal to me, Mother Superior. She doesn't really understand our relationship, and..."
"What is our relationship?"
"You command, and I obey." Terrazza looked at him over the lip of her glass. When she put down the glass, she said, "Yes, you've never really been a heretic, Miles. Perhaps someday." He spoke quickly, wanting to divert Terrazza from such ideas. "Demela thinks the long use of melange makes many people become like you."
"Is that so?"
"Isn't it odd, Miles, that a geriatric potion should have so many side effects?"
"I don't find that odd."
"No, of course you wouldn't.
She drained her glass and put it aside. I was addressing the way a significant life extension has produced in some people, you especially, a profound knowledge of human nature. We live longer and observe more, he said. I don't think it's quite that simple. Some people never observe anything. Life just happens to them. They get by on little more than a kind of dumb persistence, and they resist with anger and resentment anything that might lift them out of that false serenity. I've never been able to strike an acceptable balance sheet for the spice, he said, referring to a common mentat process of data sorting. Terraza nodded. Obviously, she found the same difficulty. We of the Sisterhood tend to be more single-track than mentats, she said. We have routines to shake ourselves out of it, but the condition persists. Our ancestors have had this problem for a long time, he said. It was different before the spice, she said. But they lived such short lives. 50, 100 years, that doesn't seem very long to us, but still, did they compress more into the available time? Oh, they were frenetic at times. She was giving him observations from her other memories, he realized. Not the first time he had shared in such ancient lore. His mother had produced such memories on occasion, but always as a lesson. Was Terraza doing that now? Teaching him something? Melange is a many-handed monster, she said. Do you sometimes wish we had never found it? The Bene Gesserit would not exist without it, nor the Guild. But there would have been no tyrant, no Moabdib. The spice gives with one hand and takes with all of its others. Which hand contains that which we desire? He asked. Isn't that always the question? You're an oddity, you know that, Miles. Mentats so seldom dip into philosophy. I think it's one of your strengths. You are supremely able to doubt. He shrugged. This turn in the conversation disturbed him. You are not amused, she said. But cling to your doubts anyway. Doubt is necessary to a philosopher. So the Zen Sunni assure us. All mystics agree on it, Miles. Never underestimate the power of doubts. Very persuasive. Story holds up doubts and surety in a single hand. Really quite surprised, he asked, Do Reverend Mothers practice Zen Sunni rituals? He had never even suspected this before. Just once, she said. We achieve an exalted form of story. Total. It involves every cell. The spice agony, he said. I was sure your mother told you. Obviously, she never explained the affinity with the Zen Sunni. Tag swallowed past a lump in his throat. Fascinating. She gave him a new insight into the Bene Gesserit. This changed his entire concept, including his image of his own mother. They were removed from him into an unattainable place where he could never follow. They might think of him as a comrade on occasion, but he could never enter the intimate circle. He could simulate no more. He would never be like Moadib or the tyrant. Prescience, Terraza said. The word shifted his attention. She had changed the subject, but not changed it. I was thinking about Moabdib, he said. You think he predicted the future, she said. That is the Mentat teaching. I hear the doubt in your voice, Miles. Did he predict or did he create? Prescience can be deadly. The people who demand that the oracle predict for them really want to know next year's price on whale fur or something equally mundane. None of them wants an instant-by-instant prediction of his personal life. No surprises, Tig said. Exactly. If you possessed such foreknowledge, your life would become an unutterable bore. You think Moabdib's life was a bore? And the tyrant's, too. We think their entire lives were devoted to trying to break out of chains they themselves created. But they believed... Remember your philosopher's doubts, Miles. Beware. The mind of the believer stagnates. It fails to grow outward into an unlimited, infinite universe. Tag sat silently for a moment. He sensed the fatigue that had been driven beyond his immediate awareness by the drink. Sensed also the way his thoughts were roiled by the intrusion of new concepts. These were things that he had been taught would weaken a Mentat, yet he felt strengthened by them. She is teaching me, he thought. There is a lesson here. As though projected into his mind and outlined there in fire, he found his entire Mentat attention fixated on the Zen Sunni admonition that was taught to every beginning student in the Mentat school. By your belief in granular singularities, you deny all movement. Evolutionary or devolutionary? Belief fixes a granular universe and causes that universe to persist. Nothing can be allowed to change because that way your non-moving universe vanishes. But it moves of itself when you do not move. It evolves beyond you and is no longer accessible to you. The oddest thing of all, Terraza said, sinking into tune with this mood she had created, is that the scientists of Ix cannot see how much their own beliefs dominate their universe. Tag stared at her, silent and receptive. Ixian beliefs are perfectly submissive to the choices they make on how they will look at their universe, Terraza said. Their universe does not act of itself, but performs according to the kinds of experiments they choose. With a start, Teg came out of the memories and awoke to find himself in the Gamu Keep. He still sat in the familiar chair in his workroom. A glance around the room showed nothing moved from where he had put it. Only a few minutes had passed, but the room and its contents no longer were alien. He dipped into and out of Mentat mode. Restored. The smell and taste of the drink Terraza had given him so long ago still tingled on his tongue and in his nostrils. A Mentat blink, and he knew he could call up the scene entire once more. The low light of shaded glow globes, the feeling of the chair beneath him, the sounds of their voices. It was all there for replay, frozen into a time capsule of isolated memory. Calling up that old memory created a magical universe where his abilities were amplified beyond his wildest expectations. No atoms existed in that magical universe, only waves and awesome movements all around. He was forced there to discard all barriers built of belief and understanding. This universe was transparent. He could see through it without any interfering screens upon which to project its forms. The magical universe reduced him to a core of active imagination, where his own image-making abilities were the only screen upon which any projection might be sensed. Therefore, I am both the performer and the performed. The workroom around Teg wavered into and out of his sensory reality. He felt his awareness constricted to its tight purpose, and yet that purpose filled his universe. He was open to infinity. Terraza did this deliberately, he thought. She has amplified me. A feeling of awe threatened him. He recognized how his daughter, Odraid, had drawn upon such powers to create the Atreides Manifesto for Terraza. His own Mentat powers were submerged in that greater pattern. Terraza was demanding a fearful performance from him. The need for such a thing both challenged and terrified him. It could very well mean the end of the sisterhood. The basic rule is this: never support weakness. Always support strength. The Bene Gesserit Coda. "How is it that you can order the priests around?" Shiana asked. "This is their place." Odraid answered casually, but picked her words to fit the knowledge she knew Shiana already possessed. "The priests have Fremen roots. They've always had Reverend Mothers somewhere near. Besides, child, you order them around, too." "That's different." Odraid suppressed a smile. Little more than 3 hours had passed since her assault force had broken the attack on the temple complex. In that time, Odraid had set up a command center in Shiana's quarters, carried on the necessary business of assessment and preliminary retaliation, all the while prompting and observing Shiana. Simulflow. Odraid glanced around the room she had chosen as command center. A scrap of Styros's ripped garments still lay near the wall in front of her. Casualties. The room was an oddly shaped place. No two walls parallel. She sniffed. Still a residual smell of ozone from the snoopers with which her people had assured the privacy of these quarters. Why the odd shape? The building was ancient, remodeled and added to many times, but that did not explain this room. A pleasantly rough texture of creamy stucco on walls and ceiling. Elaborate spice fiber hangings flanked the two doors. It was early evening, and sunlight filtered by lattice shades stippled the wall opposite the windows. Silver-yellow glow globes hovered near the ceiling, all tuned to match the sunlight. Muted street sounds came through the ventilators beneath the windows. The soft pattern of orange rugs and gray tiles on the floor spoke of wealth and security, but Odraid suddenly did not feel secure. A tall Reverend Mother came from the adjoining communications room. "Mother Commander," she said. "The messages have been sent to Guild, Ix, and Tlilazu." Odraid spoke absently. "Acknowledged." The messenger returned to her duties. "What are you doing?" Shiana asked. "Studying something." Odraid pursed her lips in thought. Their guides through the temple complex had brought them along a maze of hallways and stairs, glimpses of courtyards through arches, then into a splendid Ixian suspensor tube system, which carried them silently to another hallway, more stairs, another curved hallway, finally into this room. Once more, Odraid swept her gaze around the room. "Why are you studying this room?" Shiana asked. "Hush, child." The room was an irregular polyhedron, with a smaller side to the left, about 35 meters long, half that at the widest. Many low divans and chairs in various degrees of comfort. Shiana sat in queenly splendor on a bright yellow chair with wide, soft arms. Not a chair dog in the place. Much brown and blue and yellow fabric. Odraid stared at the white lattice of a ventilator above a painting of mountains on the wider end wall. A cool breeze came through the ventilators below the windows and wafted toward the ventilator above the painting. "This was Headley's room," Shiana said. "Why do you annoy him by using his first name, child?" "Does that annoy him?" "Don't play word games with me, child. You know it annoys him, and that's why you do it."
"Then why did you ask?"
Odraid ignored this while continuing her careful study of the room. The wall opposite the painting stood at an oblique angle to the outer wall. She had it now. Clever. This room had been constructed so that even a whisper here could be heard by someone beyond the high ventilator. No doubt the painting concealed another airway to carry sounds from this room. No snooper, sniffer, or other instrument would detect such an arrangement. Nothing would beep at a spying eye or ear. Only the wary senses of someone trained in deception had winkled it out. A hand signal summoned a waiting acolyte.
Odrade's fingers flickered in silent communication. Find out who is listening beyond that ventilator. She nodded toward the ventilator above the painting. Let them continue. We must know to whom they report.
How did you know to come and save me? Shiana asked. The child had a lovely voice, but it needed training, Odrade thought. There was a steadiness to it, though, that could be shaped into a powerful instrument.
Answer me, Shiana ordered. The imperious tone startled Odrade, arousing quick anger, which she was forced to suppress. Corrections would have to be made immediately.
Calm yourself, child, Odrade said.
She pitched the command in a precise tenor and saw it take effect.
Again Shiana startled her.
That's another kind of voice. You're trying to call me. Kupuna told me all about voice. Odrade turned squarely facing Shiana and looked down at her. Shiana's first grief had passed, but there was still anger when she spoke of Kupuna.
I am busy shaping our response to that attack, Odrade said. Why do you distract me? I should think you would want them punished.
What will you do to them? Tell me, what will you do?
A surprisingly vindictive child, Odrade thought. That would have to be curbed.
Hatred was as dangerous an emotion as love. The capacity for hatred was the capacity for its opposite.
Odrade said, I have sent Guild, Ix, and Flilazu the message we always dispatch when we have been annoyed. 3 words. You will pay.
How will they pay?
A proper Bene Gesserit punishment is being fashioned. They will feel the consequences of their behavior.
But what will you do?
In time, you may learn. You may even learn how we design our punishment. For now, there is no need that you know.
A sullen look came over Shiana's face. She said, You're not even angry. Annoyed. That's what you said.
Curb your impatience, child. There are things you do not understand.
The Reverend Mother from the communications room returned, glanced once at Shiana, and spoke to Odrade.
Chapter House acknowledges receipt of your report. They approve your response.
When the Reverend Mother from communications remained standing there, Odrade said, There is more. A flickering glance to Shiana spoke of the woman's reservations. Odrade held up her right palm, the signal for silent communication. The Reverend Mother responded, her fingers dancing with unleashed excitement.
Taraza's message, that Flilazu are the pivotal element. Guild must be made to pay dearly for its melange. Shut down Rakian supply to them. Throw Guild and Ix together. They will overextend selves in face of crushing competition from the scattering. Ignore fish speakers for now. They fall with Ix.
Master of Masters responds to us from Flilazu. He goes to Rakis. Trap him.
Odrade smiled softly to acknowledge that she understood. She watched the other woman leave the room.
Not only did Chapter House agree with actions taken on Rakis, a suitable Bene Gesserit punishment had been fashioned with fascinating speed. Obviously, Taraza and her advisors had anticipated this moment. Odrade allowed herself a sigh of relief. The message to Chapter House had been terse, an outline account of the attack, the list of the Sisterhood's casualties, identification of the attackers, and a confirming note to Taraza that Odrade already had transmitted the required warning to the guilty. You will pay.
Yes, those fool attackers now knew the hornet's nest had been aroused. That would create fear, an essential part of the punishment.
Shiana squirmed in her chair. Her attitude said she would now try a new approach.
One of your people said there were face dancers. She gestured with her chin toward the roof.
What a vast reservoir of ignorance this child was, Odrade thought. That emptiness would have to be filled.
Face dancers.
Odrei thought about the bodies they had examined. Luckily, Lazu had finally sent their new-faced dancers into action. It was a test of the Bene Gesserit, of course. These new ones were extremely difficult to detect. They still gave off the characteristic smell of their unique pheromones, though. Odred had sent that datum in her message to Chapter House. The problem now was to keep the Bene Gesserit knowledge secret. Odred summoned an acolyte messenger. Indicating the ventilator with a flick of her eyes, Odred spoke silently with her fingers. Kill those who listen. You are too interested in voice, child, Odred said, speaking down to Shiana in the chair. Silence is a most valuable tool for learning. But could I learn voice? I want to learn it. I am telling you to be silent and to learn by your silence. I command you to teach me voice. Odred reflected on Kapuna's reports. Shiana had established effective voice control over most of those around her. The child had learned it on her own. An intermediate-level voice for a limited audience. She was a natural. Tuwek and Kenya and the others were frightened by Shiana. Religious fantasies contributed to that fear, of course, but Shiana's mastery of voice pitch and tone displayed an admirable, unconscious selectivity. The indicated response to Shiana was obvious, Odred knew. Honesty. It was a most powerful lure, and it served more than one purpose. I am here to teach you many things, Odred said. But I do not do this at your command. Everyone obeys me, Shiana said. She's barely into puberty and already at aristocrat level, Odred thought. Gods of our own making, what can she become? Shiana slipped out of her chair and stood looking up at Odred with a questioning expression. The child's eyes were on a level with Odred's shoulders. Shiana was going to be tall, a commanding presence, if she survived. You answer some of my questions, but you won't answer others, Shiana said. You said you've been waiting for me, but you won't explain. Why won't you obey me? A foolish question, child. Why do you keep calling me child? Are you not a child? I menstruate. But you're still a child. The priests obey me. They're afraid of you. You aren't? No, I'm not. Good. It gets tiresome when people only fear you. The priests think you come from God. Don't you think that? Why should I? We... Odred broke off as an acolyte messenger entered. The acolyte's fingers danced in silent communication. Four priests listened. They have been killed. All were minions of Tuek. Odred waved the messenger away. She talks with her fingers, Shiana said. How does she do that? You ask too many of the wrong questions, child. And you haven't told me why I should consider you an instrument of God. Shaitan spares me. I walk on the desert, and when Shaitan comes, I talk to him. Why do you call him Shaitan instead of Shaihulud? Everybody asks that same stupid question. Then give me your stupid answer. The sullen expression returned to Shiana's face. It's because of how we met. And how did you meet? Shiana tipped her head to one side and looked up at Odred for a moment. Then, that's a secret. And you know how to keep secrets? Shiana straightened and nodded, but Odred saw uncertainty in the movement. The child knew when she was being led into an impossible position. Excellent, Odred said. The keeping of secrets is one of a Reverend Mother's most essential teachings. I'm glad we won't have to bother with that one. But I want to learn everything. Such petulance in her voice, very poor emotional control. You must teach me everything, Shiana insisted. Time for the whip. Odred thought. Tatiana had spoken and postured sufficiently that even a fifth-grade acolyte could feel confident of controlling her now. Using the full power of voice, Odrade said, "Don't take that tone with me, child. Not if you wish to learn anything." Shiana went rigid. She was more than a minute absorbing what had happened to her, and then relaxing. Presently she smiled, a warm and open expression. "Oh, I'm so glad you came. It's been so boring lately." Nothing surpasses the complexity of the human mind. Leto II, Daris Balat Records. The Gamu night, often quickly foreboding in this latitude, was almost 2 hours away. Gathering clouds shadowed the keep. At Lucilla's command, Duncan had returned to the courtyard for an intense session of self-directed practice. Lucilla observed from the parapet where she had first watched him. Duncan moved in the tumbling twists of the Bene Gesserit's eightfold combat, hurling his body across the grass, rolling, flipping himself from side to side, darting up and then down. It was a fine display of random dodging, Lucilla thought. She could see no predictable pattern in his movements, and the speed was dazzling. He was almost 16 SY, and already coming on to the platform potential of his Prana Bindu endowment. The carefully controlled movements of his training exercises revealed so much. He had responded quickly when she first ordered these evening sessions. The initial step of her instructions from Taraza had been accomplished. The Gola loved her, no doubt of it. She was mother-fixed to him. And it had been accomplished without seriously weakening him, although Teg's anxieties had been aroused. "My shadow is on this Gola, but he is not a supplicant, nor a dependent follower," she reassured herself. "Teg worries about it for no reason." Just that morning she had told Teg, "Whatever his strengths dictate, he continues to express himself freely." Teg should see him right now, she thought. These new practice movements were largely Duncan's own creation. Lucilla suppressed a gasp of appreciation at a particularly nimble leap, which took Duncan almost to the center of the courtyard. The Gola was developing a nerve-muscle equilibrium that, given time, might be matched to a psychological equilibrium at least equal to Teg's. The cultural impact of such an achievement would be awesome. Look at all those who gave instinctive allegiance to Teg, and through Teg, to the sisterhood. We have the tyrant to thank for much of that, she thought. Before Leto II, no widespread system of cultural adjustments had ever endured long enough to approach the balance that the Bene Gesserit held as an ideal. It was this equilibrium, flowing along the blade of a sword, that fascinated Lucilla. It was why she lent herself so unreservedly to a project whose total design she did not know, but which demanded of her a performance that instincts labeled repugnant. Duncan is so young. What the sisterhood required of her next had been spelled out explicitly by Taraza, the sexual imprint. Only that morning Lucilla had posed naked before her mirror, forming the attitudes and motions of face and body that she knew she would use to obey Taraza's orders. In artificial repose, Lucilla had seen her own face appear like that of a prehistoric love goddess, opulent with flesh and the promise of softness into which an aroused male might hurl himself. In her education, Lucilla had seen ancient statues from the first times, little stone figures of human females with wide hips and sagging breasts that assured abundance for a suckling infant. At will, Lucilla could produce a youthful simulation of that ancient form. In the courtyard below Lucilla, Duncan paused a moment and appeared to be thinking out his next movements. Presently, he nodded to himself, leaped high and twisted in the air, landing like a springbok on one leg. which kicked him sideways into gyrations more akin to dance than to combat. Lucilla drew her mouth into a tight line of resolution. Sexual imprint. The secret of sex was no secret at all, she thought. The roots were attached to life itself. This explained, of course, why her first command seduction for the sisterhood had planted a male face in her memory. The breeding mistress had told her to expect this and not be alarmed by it. But Lucilla had realized then that the sexual imprint was a two-edged sword. You might learn to flow along the edge of the blade, but you could be cut by it. Sometimes, when that male face of her first command seduction returned unbidden into her mind, Lucilla felt confounded by it. The memory came so frequently at the peak of an intimate moment, forcing her to great efforts of concealment. "You are strengthened thus," the breeding mistresses reassured her. Still, there were times when she felt that she had trivialized something better left a mystery. A feeling of sourness at what she must do swept over Lucilla. These evenings, when she observed Duncan's training sessions, had been her favorite times each day. The lad's muscular development showed such definite progress, moving in the growth of sensitive muscles and nerve links, all of the prana bindu marvels for which the sisterhood was so famous. The next step was almost upon her, though, and she could no longer sink into watchful appreciation of her charge. Miles Tague would come up presently, she knew. Duncan's training would move again into the practice room with its more deadly weapons. Tague. Once more, Lucilla wondered about him. She had felt herself more than once attracted to him in a particular way that she recognized immediately. An imprinter enjoyed some latitude in selecting her own breeding partners, provided she had no prior commitments nor contrary orders. Tague was old, but his record suggested he might still be virile. She would not be able to keep the child, of course, but she had learned to deal with that. Why not? She had asked herself. Her plan had been simple in the extreme. Complete the imprint on the Gola, and then, registering her intent with Terrazza, conceive a child by the redoubtable Miles Tague. Practical introductory seduction had been indicated, but Tague had not succumbed. His mentat cynicism stopped her one afternoon in the dressing chamber off the weapons room. "My breeding days are over, Lucilla. The sisterhood should be satisfied with what I already have given." Tague, clad only in black exercise leotards, finished wiping his sweaty face with a towel and dropped the towel into a hamper. He spoke without looking at her. "Would you please leave me now?" So he saw through her overtures. She should have anticipated that, Tague being who he was. Lucilla knew she might still seduce him. No reverend mother of her training should fail, not even with a mentat of Tague's obvious powers. Lucilla stood there a moment, undecided, her mind automatically planning how to circumvent this preliminary rejection. Something stopped her, not anger at the rejection, not the remote possibility that he might indeed be proof against her wiles. Pride and its possible fall, there was always that possibility, had little to do with it. Dignity. There was a quiet dignity in Tague, and she had the certain knowledge of what his courage and prowess had already given to the sisterhood. Not quite sure of her motives, Lucilla turned away from him. Possibly it was the underlying gratitude that the sisterhood felt toward him. To seduce Tague now would be demeaning, not only of him, but of herself. She could not bring herself to such an action, not without a direct order from a superior. As she stood on the parapet, some of these memories clouded her senses. There was movement in the shadows at the doorway from the weapons wing. Tague could be glimpsed there. Lucilla took a firmer grip on her responses and focused on Duncan. The Gola had stopped his control tumbling across the lawn. He stood quietly, breathing deeply, his attention aimed upward at Lucilla. She saw perspiration on his face and in dark blotchings on his light blue single suit. Leaning over the parapet, Lucilla called down to him, "That was very good, Duncan. Tomorrow I will begin teaching you more of the foot-fist combinations." The words came out of her without censoring, and she knew their source at once. They were for Teg standing in the shadowed doorway down there, not for the Gola. She was saying to Teg, "See, you aren't the only one who teaches him deadly abilities."